Welcome to the Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views, as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
Have you ever watched the movie Charlie Wilson's War?
No.
Is that Tom Hanks' movie?
Yeah. Tom Hanks, Charlie Wilson's War.
I watched it a long time ago, but I can't remember it.
You got Philip Seymour Hoffman. There's like five scenes in there that I sometimes repeat out loud all the time. And one of them that I always like to bring up is the conversation with the soothsayer called "We'll See." And it's a great scene at near the end of the book, because Charlie Wilson was a senator from, or not even senator, a congressman from the state of Texas, small little town. And he got into politics because there was this guy that killed his dog when he was growing up, and he wanted to remove this guy from office. So he went down and drove like every black man to the polls to vote, and he won. And that's where he fell in love with politics. Anyways, fast forward, like, this guy single-handedly was the one that brought the budget from like a few million dollars to tens of billions of dollars to get Stinger missiles to the Afghans to shoot down the Russian helicopters. Mm. And at the end of the book, so Philip Seymour Hoffman is the CIA agent, and he is great. Like, one of the first scenes of the movie is when he's going into the director of the CIA to talk to him, like, why he didn't get this position. And he's like, I thought you were coming in here to apologize to me. He goes, me apologize to you? He goes, for what? He goes, you broke my door. And he's like, he goes, you gave, and he goes into this whole spiel. And at the end of it, he goes, do you think people try to kill me because my dad was a Greek soda pop salesman, or that I'm a CIA agent trained to kill people? F you. And he walks out and slams the door, and he goes, hey, and he takes the door again and slams it as hard as he can, so it shatters all the glass. Okay. And as he walks by, like, the guy's secretary, he turns to her, he goes, how was that? And she's like, this bump, you know? And like, he's just this great, he plays this great CIA agent. But at the end of the movie, there's this part about where he says, I'll see. And he's like, listen, he pulls Tom Hanks out. They're all celebrating. The Russians are leaving. And he goes, you need to go back in there and tell Congress they can't take away the funding. And he goes, what are you talking about? He goes, don't tell me you're about to say some really bad stuff's happening. He goes, I got a docket that came across my desk this morning that tells me every crazy from here all the way to Saudi Arabia is rolling in there right now. And he's like, what do you want me to do? He goes, start by rebuilding the roads, build the bridges, build the schools, start with the infrastructure, then from there. And he goes, I was just in their office the other day and they said, Afghanistan, what? Like, they don't care anymore. And he goes, you ever heard of the, and he says the soothsayer, but it's not the soothsayer. There's a name for it. And he goes, oh, is this another one of your stories? He goes, we'll see. He goes, talks about this little boy. He goes, this little boy, he goes, it's his birthday, blah, 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 blah. And he goes, he gets this horse and everyone's like, oh, hooray for the little boy. Like, I'm so happy for him. And the guy says, we'll see. He goes, and fast forward a year or two later, and he's riding his horse and falls off and breaks his arm. And everyone's like, oh, how bad for the little boy. And he says, we'll see. He goes, 2 days later, the whole village is going to war. All those kids go off to war. And most of them die. And everyone says, oh, how lucky for the little boy. And Tom Hanks goes, we'll see. He goes, you get it. He goes, no, I don't get it. I'm a congressman. And he goes into his spiel, right? So like, when people say to me, like, man, you are lucky to be out of automotive right now. He goes, in an industry, you know, like security. I'm like, we'll see, you know, like, yeah, today the grass is green, but is it always going to be greener on the other side? Like, we'll see. I thought it was a great point of like, everyone's real quick to rush to say, oh, how great, right? We'll see what becomes of it. And the same was true in Afghanistan. You got the Russians to leave, but if that was your only goal, was to push the Russians out, great. You did a great job. But what did you do in the meantime? You devastated an entire country.
I like the we'll see. I like the we'll see part. The we're an industry. We're doing things now, and it's interesting. But nothing is static. Nothing ever, and everything we do has downstream implications. You know, not talking butterfly effect, but you know that the things we do, the actions we take now, will shape the future and will shape the pros and cons down the road. And that makes for interesting thought, and I guess, and hopefully encourages people to think about the, not just the today impact, but the tomorrow impact of the things we're doing in security and technology, and just society in general, which I don't know that people always do think about that.
No, I think the majority of people live in the just today. I'm just focused on what I need to do right now, not thinking.
Just this hour.
Well, it's the same thing when we've talked about privacy, right? We talk about what if, hypothetically, what if we do nothing? That means that companies that are curbing the terms of use, that are curbing how we can market to people, how we can use data, they get to choose. If we leave it open-ended, they get to create the narrative. They get to make this whatever they want to do. And we just have to live with it in hopes that, okay, if they go too far, well, then we'll talk about legislation and see if we can reel them back. It doesn't work like that.
Right. I mean,
it's literally what he just talked about when you said that if you look at that whole sphere of from politicians, from power all the way on up, what's been feeding it for X number of years of keeping certain people in power and a certain narrative moving forward. If that same thing was to happen on the privacy side, which it kind of feels like it is, right? Then the more power, the more larger, not even larger, the more power those companies have, and the more certain people understand the money that comes from that. Like you said, it's monetized. Then keep filtering, whether it's setting the right rules, the right laws, the right precedents, and just keep pushing that forward.
Yeah, and then, but the flip side is, though, the other perspective, I won't say the flip side, the other perspective you need to take, though, is our society better as a whole, as a result of having been given access to the kinds of information, algorithmic preferences, things that come from collecting and using large scale amounts of data. And I'll reference, and as I say this, I'll say, please remember the opening of the program, in which we say the views we talk about aren't necessarily our own, even our own. I just want to point this out. I mean, what do you guys think? Are we better off now as a society because we've allowed this collection and use of data? We've got great tools. We've got great visibility into other people. In theory, we're better connected with people. Are we better off?
Well, Dan, it depends.
Ugh, I missed
that. Gotcha. Gotcha.
Never ask a question again, lest I not get to say it. Go ahead.
It so does depend, though, because in certain arenas, I feel like we've been sold a bill of goods. It's like what I was texting you guys, this idea that, hey, you know what you really need, you want and need ads that are curtailed directly to you because you don't want to see just any generic ads. We need to track your data and what you're doing so that we can sell you exactly what you're looking for. That's BS. There is no greater good out of that outside of the company that's doing the marketing. There is nothing from a personal perspective that I gain from it other than, well, I'm probably going to spend more money. It's the Amazon effect, right? Because it's so simple and because I can do it. Well, all right, now, wait, I can have that in 2 days? Yep, I'm going to buy it and have it here. Now, on the flip side, I do agree with you with the aggregating data. I mean, if you look at what we're doing, whether it be in kind of DNA testing, stuff like that, aggregation, looking at different ways that we can move society, create, I don't know, whether it be different medical things, right, that we can use to move society and help them. And the aggregation of data, I think, in some of those fields doesn't need to be associated back to a given person, you know, getting to the privacy aspects and anonymization. But yes, I will say in that case that the idea of big data and just having pools of resources that we can pull together to look at trends and stuff like that, that has moved the needle. There are some benefits there. But I go back.
Trust people to use it only for that.
Correct.
I mean, but okay, that's, okay, and so I guess I'll decouple. I will rescind that, because if you use it for its intended purpose, I totally agree. Sorry, continue.
And no, but that's kind of getting to the crux of it. And I think that's why I'm a huge proponent of needing some type of federal privacy legislation forcing anonymization of that data. Can the data be used for good? Yes. But let's strip away the potential, the thought that I could use it for something other than what it was intended for. Let's put constraints around it. The EU did this. The EU, and we talked about this, I think, in our first podcast, right? The EU came out and said, privacy is an inalienable right. We don't know what the companies are going to do down the road. We don't care. We're going to put guardrails around it today and protect where it's going in the future. And I think we need to snap back that same way here in the US.
Has GDPR, we're two plus years into GDPR. Has it been effective? Are people in Europe better protected than they were 2 years ago? Is the data about people in Europe better protected than it was two years ago? Are they, I'll agree, they're more aware of the data that's coming, but do they really have material choice?
When you say better protected, I mean better protected so that that data isn't getting in the hands of somebody in terms of a threat actor or another organization to be monetized, or better protected from organizations today monetizing the data on people?
The second one. It's the alternate uses. It's the non-transparent uses. That was the intention of GDPR. GDPR wasn't there. You know, there's always been breach requirements and data protection requirements. If it's sensitive, you've got to store it, and you've got to store it safely. They haven't always been as toothy as, you know, as they could have been. And those have been beefed up over the years, but there's never been the allowance that you could let these things flap freely, you know, out in the wind and let them be taken. I'm definitely referring to the second, that, you know, that the uses of them are both documented and clear, that it's been made transparent to, you know, that people can have conscious choice of how their data is being used. And one of those conscious choices can be, I don't use your service.
And explain what GDPR is and means for the listeners out there that just heard a new acronym like GDPR.
GDPR is Europe's General Data Protection Regulation. It went into it's an evolution of an older EU Data Privacy Directive that's been in place. I mean, this has been in place for 10, 12, 13 years now. The Data Protection Directive. Now GDPR is went into law May of 2018. It has equal bearing across all 27, yeah, I don't know what state the UK is in these days, 27 EU nations, and basically requires, explicit consent. It requires, you know, transparent, clear documentation of how data is being used, meaningful choice. It's about transparency, saying what you're doing and then doing what you say you're going to do with it.
And for the listeners, that's kind of where the recent law came from in California, which is in opt out, not opt in. Eric, I'm going to let you answer this. Here is my conspiracy theory thoughts. Okay. And this goes back to Cambridge Analytica. A company like that finds a way to use data from Facebook, Google, all these other platforms. That company was based out of the UK. The UK is trying to find a way to break itself from the rest of the EU. What's going to happen with the GDPR requirements? I think everybody should know that's listening right now that the fiber optic cables, when people refer to a cloud and things are stored in the cloud, let's actually look underwater at these cables that are transferring data, you know, from one region to another. And several of those cables actually come up in the European continent or in Europe through England. And it wasn't so long ago that it was very easy, if you were an American company, to tap into those lines over on that side of the pond because the laws were really ambiguous over there where you couldn't do it over here. So if you didn't think that you were being spied on as America or data was being looked at, et cetera, think again. And there's enough documentation out there that if you don't think I'm making this up as I'm going along, I'm not. It's true. It happened. Cambridge Analytica did a lot of really interesting stuff with data that's aggregated every day from Facebook, Google, et cetera. So if you think that President Trump is worried about TikTok, you're damn right he is. Why? Because they could do the same thing Data Analytica could because it was gathering some of the same data that TikTok's going to. The difference is TikTok could send it over to China. So is Europe better off with GDPR? I think it's talked about more in my personal opinion. Why? Because companies don't want to pay fines.
Right.
That's the bottom line. Once you made the companies responsible, but people still don't understand what data of theirs is out there and why it relates to privacy.
That was a great parallel on the TikTok. You beat me to it. I was going to throw that in there as well. That's the modern day. So from my perspective, I think kind of going back to the original question, has it moved the needle? I think it's hard to quantify. Right. If we're trying to boil it down to numbers to say statistically, this is how much better are, I think you're really going to struggle there. But anecdotally, what we do know is looking at the companies that fall under GDPR, their decision making structure has to change. Or like Brian, like you said, that they face big fines. So it forces them to go through the thoughts. Should I collect this data? OK, if I'm going to collect this data, what's the intent? Do I really need it? Because everything that you collect at some point, you have the chance that you have to reproduce if you get the request from the consumer, which creates a lot of extra work and overhead. It is a lot of time fulfilling those GDPR requests. So you have to go through the thought process of really, do I really want this data? Am I going to really have to reproduce it? And do I want to be in a position down the road where I have to defend having it?
And but I in think- theory, you could build automated systems. I'm thinking about the rationalization for this. I was having some discussions earlier this week about, you know, should we collect this? Should we keep this? What do you think? And the rationalization can be made if you make a system that allows you to keep it and then easily delete it. It makes it much easier to go, well, fine, I'll just keep it. And you just output it easily. You know, we look at some and make it self-service. It then makes it a lot easier to justify to yourself, well, of course I can keep it. I can delete it upon request. You do still have to deal with the why, you know, why did I collect it in the first place? Why are you collecting DNA samples for me to eat it at a local restaurant? most cases aren't quite that clear cut as to why it's not there, why it's not necessary.
Right.
But I think people are getting wise to this. And, you know, I'm going to turn October is Cybersecurity Awareness Month into October is Cybersecurity Awareness and Privacy Awareness Month.
100%.
I think this is one of those topics that is more and more prevalent, especially as we in the U.S. run up to an upcoming election. We know that there's a lot of data being collected about people. We know that the campaigns have, you know, large dossiers on most of America in some way. You know, what is that data for? Is it collected? Is it for the greater good? And you know, what does it net? What does it net the person about whom it pertains? It isn't just about the campaigns in general. There's, you know, I guess, do I benefit from somebody using my data, which I have no agency over?
Right. It depends.
I was going to throw something out there. The census, right? Census is going on right now.
Mm-hmm. Yay, census.
Did you say what is census?
I said yay, census.
Oh, I thought you said what is census. I'm a big fan of
the census. I think the census, when done, you know, every 10 years, we get such great insights into what the nation is. This is one of those cases where the data collection has absolute value. We understand what America is.
It's funny that when you say like there's value in the data that they're gathering. So one thing I found was because we have a cottage and then we have another location, the census information would show up over at the cottage along with a ton of other mail, right? So apparently after like a month and a half, they sent somebody out on a weekend, which is when I'm there, and did the census right there at the top of my driveway, right? Filled mm-hmm. out the information, et cetera. The interesting part about it was they did it on a tablet, right? So it was very easy for them to do. And I kept thinking to myself, like, man, it would have been nice if I had just gotten an email, right, that I could have pulled up, filled out the information online. Now, when she gave me the little pamphlet, there was an area where I could have just gone in and done it online had I been reading all of that. My next thought process to this was, so Dan, you said there's some really important information that comes from it. Yeah, I would agree there, but the government's already been buying up tons of information from companies, a handful of companies, a really big one out of Arkansas, that takes all the data about Americans, and it's already being broken down into categories, like 20 to 30 different groups and subsets based on age, ethnicity, how much money you make, everything. Like they spent all this time. They sent someone to my house on a weekend to find out how many kids I have, right? It was like 10 questions, but yet they probably have a book about Brian Schneebly that they paid for. They're some of the biggest buyers of that data.
But it's the law.
Right.
The census is the law. Well, okay. So yeah.
I had to say that laughingly. I get that it's the law and there's good that comes from it. But at the same time, on the flip side, there's parts of the government that are spending X amount of money. So when we talk about Cybersecurity Month in privacy, why both kind of meet right here, right? And why people should be concerned with privacy and why we brought up GDPR. There's all this data that's out there that's gathered every day. And Social Dilemma, I thought, was a kind of a good eye opener for people, because I started getting emails from friends, or not emails, text messages saying, so is this why you're not on Facebook anymore? And it was like, that was one of the big reasons why I'm not on Facebook anymore. There's some other reasons too.
But my quality of life went up when I left Facebook.
Yeah. I started investing in LinkedIn, literally. In reality, like, if people don't realize how much data can be collected, and not just data, just analytics about who you are and what you like and what you want to see, right? That it makes it very, I can think back to the previous election and know that some of the stuff that was put in front of me absolutely focused my direction and my opinion one way rather than the other. And I very well can look back and say, yeah, I was talking about it around bonfires and gatherings with friends where I'd say, yeah, but you know, this happened, you know, that happened, right? All because it was put in front of me on a daily basis.
Well, that's the amazing thing. And anybody who hasn't watched a Netflix special, The Social Dilemma, highly, highly recommend it. Great, great video. It was really well done. But you know, you think about what was one of the lines from there, that the only two places that use, or two organizations that call their, I'm going to mess this up. What was the
line? People that use their product users instead of customers, right, are
social media and then drug cartels.
Well, software in general.
But it's crazy when you start thinking about the different echo chambers that social media creates, and that anybody. So a book recommendation, Coddling of the American Mind, highly, highly recommend that one. And it goes into what social media has done. Social media is like a drug, right? That it wants to give you just a little bit to pull you back in. I'm going to send you a like, I'm going to send you a notification. Come back to me. I have more information for you.
Endorphin.
I'm not saying it's correct information. It's just information. And it echoes back whatever you put into it. And it creates that echo chamber so that, and it gets into this in the book, that what you see is you stop, you get detached from reality, that you get so hyper-focused, and what's thrown back at you is what you think you believe or what you should believe, that you then get detached from somebody else that has an alternative view, that you no longer can rationalize how anybody else could see anything else, because all of the information that's presented to you is what you thought you should believe. And that's crazy. That it's gone to these lengths, and how detrimental that can be to society.
Eric, there was a book about empathy in the workplace. Well, not just empathy in the workplace. I'm trying to remember. We've talked about it before, and I was just trying to pull it up. I'm like all the different books I've read. But it also talks about, why a good boss has empathy, but it also talks about the person themselves and where naturally the drugs that you create in your body, what creates happiness, what creates sadness. When you look at the idea of dopamine, and other things that occur within the body, that's what one of those things that Facebook does, right? People are looking for, and I thought the movie does a good job of it. Like, oh, is she going to like my post? Right. And then they like it. It's like, boom, all of a sudden you get that shot. Right. And it's like, well, I need another one. You know, like I need another shot of that. It's that feel good moment. Right. And I was trying to explain that too, to my son. And this goes back a year or two ago when I was trying to explain those things as he's getting ready, you know, in middle school, and he's going to be going to high school, of, you know, these things that happen. And one of them was, and I think I told you guys, I shared this with you before, Eric, he started to date someone, or in, he's probably listening to me right now. He's like, no, I wasn't. But he had a girlfriend per se, and, you know, followed up like a month later, Kelly and I had asked, you know, what happened to so-and-so. And he's like, oh, well, she kind of broke up with me, or just isn't talking to me. And I asked why, and he's like, I don't know. Well, then Kelly came and talked to me, and she goes, Brian, she goes, it's actually because she would text him and he wouldn't reply back because you wouldn't allow him to have his phone. And the phone's only allowed to be used at different times. And I can remember telling him before this even happened, beware of text, beware of these social media, everything else, that if you send a note and you don't get a reply back, it's the not knowing part. And I used to preach this in college. What's the hardest thing in life? Not knowing.
Knowing.
It's taking an exam and then having to wait a week to find out how you did and hear everybody talk like, yeah, I think I did really good. Or, and now you're wondering, you go on a date and then before text messaging exists, you go home. And for the next 2 days, you're like, I wonder if she had a good time. I wonder if she likes me, right? It's that not knowing. Now it's instantaneous. Like you get home, it's like, so what'd you think of the date tonight? Oh, I love the carrot cake. Now you're continuing the date for another 2.5 hours talking about everything else before you go to bed, right? You need that. You need that rush, you know? And when he told me that, it broke my heart. And I was like, that's exactly what I'm talking about. That anxiety that people have that you didn't write back, in their mind, something told them, oh, he doesn't like me. And all of a sudden it's spurring all these additional thoughts and boom, that's what these different social media outlets and everything else have done. What they don't realize is that inside the human body and what it does to people's emotions and the dopamine levels and everything else, that's where depression comes from.
Right. It's that. Go ahead, Dan.
I was saying there's two referential points I'll make. One, there's a great episode of Black Mirror. Do you guys ever watch Charlie Brooker's Black Mirror? Great series around dystopian futures involving technology and other things. And there's one, you know, instant, every interaction you have with someone, you rate them.
I'm giving this interaction right now 5 stars, Dan.
Right, exactly, 5 stars. And then the other one was, it was Amazon's Upload. If you haven't watched that, really interesting.
Yeah, that one's good too.
Similar type of interaction, which reinforces exactly what you were saying. And we are moving, they're dystopian concepts. They are the future concepts, but we are moving ever closer to that instant gratification. You mentioned about tests, waiting a week to get back. It was never an issue. Now, if I don't have instant gratification, if I don't have instant response from something, I can't function. You know, as a society, we have difficulty functioning if we don't get that instant answer. And this is moving us back toward making decisions that are good for the moment, not necessarily good for the long term. And I can't recall if we were having this discussion before or after we started recording, but about, you know, planning and doing more of looking at the implications of the things we do in, over the long term, not just the short term. And this comes back, you know, loops right back around to data collection, right, and privacy.
We've moved into the Charlie Brown, Lucy calls herself pretty and you didn't respond quick enough. You don't think I'm pretty? You don't think I'm pretty? Right?
Like, yeah.
The whole idea then, and it's not totally a new concept, then in the absence of feedback, the absence of data, the mind tends to drift, right? You get to create your own narrative. You get to create your own story on what might be going on. It's kind of the rear window thing, right? It's, I'm just watching. I've got nothing better to do. But I think that has been exacerbated. It's been sped up by social media and this pull to instant gratification. Well, I need to know right now. I need the alert. Somebody send me something, please.
Right.
But I was going to go back, Brian, actually, when you're talking about the government collecting data and all of that, you know, we've had the conversation here before about organizations. So taking it into the private sector about self-policing, right? And that's kind of the whole idea on privacy. Should the government create something, or should the onus be on the company to self-police? And does that become marketable for the company itself and how they go to market? But if we go back, and I can't remember if it was during the last election cycle or further back than that, that there was speculation that, what was it, IRS data that was used to target certain voters of a certain political party, kind of going after them for certain tax-related information and stuff like that. But can you trust somebody who is collecting a mass amount of data that they are going to use it only for that intended purpose? Or is there a draw that, oh, I've got this data. I wonder what else I could do with it.
Sorry, Dan, I was going to ask, what data ends up being classified as private, meaning privacy? And where I'm going with this is, there's certain information about myself that can then be used to be monetized. There's other information about myself that can also be monetized that I don't want other people to have. And where I'm flipping this to is, if I own a plot of land and somebody finds out that there's oil on that their land, they come in and pay rights, you know, to go ahead and draw oil from that land. The same thing if they find great water, all right? They pay money to extract that water out. Now, if you find out that you have this really good plethora of data on Brian Schneebly and you can use it to monetize it, how come I don't get paid for that?
Because we don't have agency over our own data. There are identity models.
To take a step further, though. No, go ahead, Dan. Sorry.
I had to break for a cough. there are identity models that involve shifting control over your data to the user yourself. And you say, here, go back to things like the way SAML is. Attributes are controlled by the service provider, by the person who's issuing the identity, and say, you can have these five pieces of data, metadata about a person when you connect up and send down. There are identity models that involve doing that same kind of thing to the user themselves. You have a single source of identity. All the data is stored and protected, and I decide which elements I give out and to whom. It puts a lot of onus on the user, and it takes a lot away from those that are doing passive collection. Now, the challenge here is, in this country, this is capitalism. You know, this is all rooted in money. And I think there's a difference between that which is government data and that which is commercially collected or non-government data. And government data, I think, still does have some level of data protection. And I want to reinforce the reuse of the word data protection versus privacy. Because data protection gives a lot more clear definition. It's a lot clearer about what it is you're trying to do. You're trying to govern, control. Privacy has a much more closed feel to it. Don't come in, don't come in, don't take any of it. Data protection is that balanced item. But on the government side, I think that is fairly well established. Data that's there, unless it leaks, unless it's not well protected, that's a different case, different story. And it's used theoretically for the things it's intended for. But on the company side, on the commercial side, it is all about how to monetize, how to drive the street and make, you know, fulfill obligations you have to shareholders versus to customers or versus to society. Those are not the target demographics. Those are not target audiences for what you know, modern American business is all about. And so therefore they don't have the control. So go ahead.
To counter that though, the Business Roundtable did come out and say, no. Shareholder value, you are beholden to shareholders, but after community first. And community is privacy. And I think the whole debate comes down to are privacy rights inalienable or alienable? And that's what we're fundamentally debating in the US. And we haven't made, as of right now, they're alienable. I can transfer ownership of my privacy to somebody else in hopes for some goods or service. I mean, Brian, building on what
right, you don't even have the right to transfer it. It's like happening without you.
But Brian, building it, not only are you not getting paid for your information, you're paying to give them your information. You're buying their goods and services. You're creating the information that then, not only do you give them money for those goods and services, but then they get to make even more off of all of that data you just created. That's crazy to me.
And connected car is the one that I'm most interested to see. You know, we're all in Detroit, you know, where connected car goes and whether or not people will buy into the idea that this steady stream of data, 5G is here now. And it is going to realize the continuous stream of data that goes out from the car, where you go, what you do, how will the companies that collect that information use it, protect it, and give the driver, give the passengers a level of protection. I'm really interested to see where this goes. I think it's an opportunity for people to do really good for society or really not good for society.
I'm hoping for the good. I mean, it's the eternal optimist in me that it'll go the right direction. I mean, if we look at, you know, texting about Apple, right? Apple went to, they're now, they've got a logo with a lock in the, that they're marketing themselves as, well, we're a privacy company. We're a security company because we care about you. And I mean, you take that debate back years, they prove that as well, right? Think about the government subpoenas or the government wanting a backdoor into information. They said, no, we're not going to do that because the consumer protection comes first. And I think that's a great stance. I was going through and I was Googling because I was interested that the two camps, President Trump and candidate Biden, what they kind of their stance on the whole privacy. And they both have statements on it. Now, it's a little excerpt that I found. So President Trump came out and said he supports national consumer privacy legislation with, quote, the appropriate balance between privacy and prosperity. And I think that's probably a good fit for where we are in the US, right? That we're going to try to find some balance. And then candidate Biden said, we should be worried about the lack of privacy, and this was pertaining to tech platforms, and should be setting standards not unlike the Europeans are doing relative to privacy. And to me, I mean, depending on, they're a little bit different statements, but I'm hopeful that they're both acknowledging it, that, hey, this is a need, that if we don't get out in front of this, we may be too far gone to try to reel it back in any meaningful way or time frame.
To clarify, though, I think just from some of the people I've talked with that aren't in InfoSec or deal with privacy, just your standard consumer, in conversations I've had, their idea of what privacy is that they couldn't believe like Citibank had this happen and their information got out. Like, oh, I lost my privacy. And I'm like, no, I think you're missing it. Like that information got out, there was a breach or this happened. But the idea of privacy is that certain information about you isn't already collected and monetized. Or like, yes, your information got out there, that didn't necessarily have to do with privacy. And yes, you could pay fines, GDPR, et cetera. But the difference between security and privacy and then securing the data that you're gathering on people, right, to keep that data private is different than what we're talking about in terms of privacy, correct?
Right.
Yes. Yeah. And I think, again, back to the changing of the term to think about it as data protection versus privacy helps. I think it reinforces your description there, reinforces how those two terms are materially different, and data protection is really what people are striving for.
So
go ahead, Eric.
I was going to say, pulling this into the role of the CISO then, is this another evolutionary step CISOs need to take? You know, if we look over history, we had cybersecurity. What's cybersecurity? I'm worried about the technical side, right? I'm worried about protecting servers and websites, and it's all very technical focus. And then it kind of morphed into, well, no, this has grown into information security. And now we're focused on broader, the data that we have. How is the data being used? Is the next evolutionary step of the CISO getting into privacy?
Yes.
I agree. I think it has.
This is not, it depends. This is yes. And I think both because the role of the Office of Information Security has changed. Like you said, you described it, it has changed, it has evolved, it has become far more business aware. And I use that for, you know, this is an audio program, so you can't see the air quotes around business aware, but it really is that it is no longer just defend the perimeter, defend the perimeter. It is about how do we use these things to enable the organizations that we do, that we support and serve to do better things, to do things better for customers, for shareholders, for others, for society. And data protection is one of those. Previously had been thought that these two things were orthogonal, because data protection has long been about that balance, finding that middle ground. And security had often been about blocking. As those two, as security evolves and becomes much more business aware, the ethos of both data protection and security, information security, are becoming on that same level of balance. And these two things are coming together. For a while, I wondered if privacy, if data privacy, data protection would end up with chief data officers. My thought on that is shrinking. I think that security is where these two things are harmonizing most. And I'm really excited to see it, because it's really forced information security professionals and leaders to up their game, to think about valid ways to use these, to use data, how to be honest with people about how to help the businesses be honest about what they're doing, and make rational decisions about, should we be doing this? Just because you can doesn't mean you should. And I think that I've seen an increase in security people, security organizations, helping build ethics into organizations, or helping to define ethics within organizations, perhaps for the first time. Not saying that organizations are unethical, but rather saying helping them draw the box around the boundaries they're willing to cross and not cross when it comes to their business. By having these boundaries, it helps them to know when they're going to cross them and decide if this materially changes their business. Clearly, I have no opinion on this topic.
None whatsoever.
I cede the floor.
Well, I remember when we were all sitting around having dinner back in March, right into February.
We used to be able to do that?
Yeah. So that was 1 BC, okay? 1 month before COVID. Actually, it was almost like 2 weeks before COVID. And I reached across, I can't say I reached across the table, but I sat across the table. I said, for everyone here that works for an automotive company, know this, history will judge you, okay? If there's one thing you've seen from Google, from Facebook, from everybody else, history is already judging them, all right? Google's motto or mantra used to be, don't be evil. They don't even have that mantra anymore. Once Facebook came around, it was, let's figure out how to monetize, keep people on, gather as much data as we can, because data is power. Everybody wanted to get into the automotive side of it, right? Amazon, Google, everybody tried to jump in. But when you look at the amount of capital investment it takes to build a vehicle and to build it well, Tesla's learning that. And for everyone listening right now, if you look at the valuation of Tesla and think that's accurate, blowing smoke up your behind, all right? As of today, one, they've only had one quarter where they've ever shown a profit. Two, they haven't figured out a road to profitability because they're a manufacturing company. Call them tech. They build a vehicle. You build the tech in. Same with all the other autos. Yeah. And they're trying to do that. And it's really hard to.
But I was gonna say, going tangential on that, my understanding is the majority of the revenue right now is coming from selling carbon credits anyways, that it's offsetting. They're selling it to the other manufacturers.
Right.
Yep. And when you make up less than 1% of the market, I get it that it's growing. But automotive and building a vehicle that's that capital intensive comes from building at scale, all right? But if there's one thing these auto companies know, it's that that data, right, is like the last frontier for them. If there's anything to move them back in the talk of being profitable year over year, it's that data. And yes, they're taking it serious, but they also spend years upon years testing. I mean, GM doesn't bring in one brake company, test the brakes against, say, bicycle brake company B and say, yep, best brakes out there. We're going to put them in a vehicle. They test every brake company, right? And then you spend years evaluating before you go to market. Sometimes things happen and you have to recall those, fix them as quickly as possible. And the autos have been judged on what they did in the past. And there's things that are back there. They've been around for 100 plus years and they've learned from those experiences. A lot of the tech companies have not. And this data, I mean, I mean, the amount of money that can be generated from it. And it's not capital intensive in terms of you're not having to build all this other equipment, et cetera. But the next question becomes, where do you store all of this data? You look at the data farms. When people hear the word cloud, they think it's stored in the cloud. Sorry, guys, there's not a bunch of weird different size clouds up there that roll in and out every day, sometimes raining, that store our data. All right. It's actually stored somewhere. All right. And these things take up space, a lot of space. And the amount of energy they suck is a lot of energy. So there's a whole nother component to the amount of data that's going to come out. And then what data do you hold? What makes that data valuable? And then going back to that, if you own the vehicle, right, and they're gathering data, do you own the data then? It's your vehicle. You bought it. Does the model of how to sell vehicles change? And Eric, you're in the business of also selling vehicles.
That's two different questions. On the retail side, that's an ongoing debate on, because it gets into who owns the customer, right? Does the OEM own the customer? Does the dealership own the customer? And that is, it's not any different than and many other verticals that are having those data ownership debates. I mean, on the vehicle side, it becomes very interesting because I think the vehicle, it's probably much easier to delineate or to anonymize the data, right? You have the data that pertains to a given vehicle, and then you've got the data, the tie points that tie it up to the actual customer, right? If you tease the two apart, then I think you can create a clear demarcation of who owns what. Because I don't think, me personally, I don't know as a consumer, I don't know if I care a lot to own the data about my vehicle. You know, I would prefer in the connected car that is extremely complex and all the things going on. I want the OEM to be looking at that data. I want to know if there's going to be something wrong. I don't want to be the guy that finds out my brakes are going to go out after they go out. But I want you to catch up.
Let me throw an interesting question then to you, Eric. So right now, like my side collision isn't working, right? And I took it in. And lo and behold, because my daughter ripped the seat panel off the back of my driver's seat on this beautiful leather seat, something became unplugged. And they said that in order to fix it, it was like $350. And I was like, I'll plug it in myself. Thanks. But now let's say whatever happened keeps data from being gathered. Now, and I'm like, well, I'm not going to pay the $300 to get X fixed. But to Eric, your point, if there's this monetization, if some of the data that's being gathered is of the highest value, we'll call it the gold standard data, that's not being gathered now, does the OE send someone out and say, hey, we need to fix that car for him. We need to be gathering that data.
Well, this is exactly what I've been thinking about as I get close to buying a new car or not buying a new car. I do not have a connected car at the moment. It's pre telematics. It's pre everything, but I keep wondering, and I've done a lot of research on how can you materially disable the telematics. Can I go in? Can I unplug the OnStar? Can I unplug the Ford sync or various things and actually make it materially disconnected? That should be a choice I have. I know in Europe, you do have the choice. I think OnStar can actually be hard cut off. That's not the case here in the US. But those are the kind of decisions that go into my buying. And if you take this back, and my guess is, Brian, to answer your question, my guess is at every service that I do, that I will either be, if I do find a way to disconnect it, I will either be queried or it will be rehooked up, because that is valuable to them. If you take this to the television set, the CEO of Vizio, V-I-Z-I-O, no correlation to the drawing and to the drawing application, came out a couple of years ago now, and said, you know, the pricing on our television is such that it is subsidized, expecting that we're going to collect mountains of data about what it is that you're watching. Even if you're not watching stuff through our smart TV, it's still reporting back the things it sees on the screen. There's software in televisions now that that looks at what's on the screen and reports back, even if it's not coming through their smart functions. And that's how we make the prices of our smart TVs so low. It's baked in. You can at the moment not connect the television to the internet. You can use outboard boxes and not have the TV connected in order to get around that. But it's clear, and then there's no hiding of it. There's no, it's part of the business model. We want to sell you things cheaper, and you want to buy things cheaper because that apparently is the metric of the day. Can we get things cheaper, and buy more widgets with our with our hard-earned money, but not and we've stopped veiling the offset of this is collecting data, which I think is a good step. The fact that I think it's good in terms of transparency. Yep, you buy this TV, you buy a smart TV. Guess what? You're only paying one half of what it is. We see it with console devices. Those they've been clear for a long time. We sell many of them at a loss in order to, and we make it up on the games.
I'm gonna let Vizio try to figure me out. I'm gonna buy a Vizio TV that I'm only gonna use once a year for the Michigan State game. Connect it, play the game. Right at every tailgate, and that's the only time it'll be used. And let them figure out: A, is he a Michigan fan, a Michigan State fan? And then, do I only get football ads?
They will query your credit card ad. They'll query your credit card data that they buy a different way and be able to figure it out without worrying. It's just supplemental.
And that's. But I think this brings up and driving it back to Brian's question. This is the nuance of privacy, right? That Vizio came out and said, "Hey, here's what we're going to do. We're just letting you know." But they aren't creating a fundamental right that you have to give them that information. Because like you said, Dan, you don't have to connect it to the internet.
Today.
Same thing with the car, Brian, right? If it breaks, sorry, they had the ability, and we were okay with the ability for them to collect the data off of the car, but they don't have a fundamental right to connect the data off the car. Meaning if the connection gets severed, so be it. It's on me as the consumer, the owner of that car, then that I get to choose if it gets reconnected or not.
So on that note, I'll give one last item and then I think we need to wrap it up for today, unfortunately, because clearly there's going to be Privacy Drone 3. this is Privacy Drone 2 and our first episode, Privacy Drone 1. But the ties, there's an explicit act of connecting to a network that makes those happen. Cars are automatically connected now to networks, whether or not you buy the onboard Wi-Fi, there's still cellular connectivity that's happening behind the scenes. I'll put in the show notes a link to a new item that Amazon is touting that is called Amazon Sidewalk. It's local area networks. It's like small area mesh networks that will be auto-connected. The spec now is that it's opt-in, but these are the kind of mesh networks that over time become very prevalent. People start to you start to depend on them, and you connect all your things into them. Now do you stop having thinking about the act now and what the future implications are? Do you stop having the ability to opt out of those things? That in conjunction with the fact that so many new pieces of hardware, and this is not just high tech, this is fridges and other things, actually don't know how to function if they're not phoning home. Smart devices are expecting to have some kind of server service, which is ends their life early when the server decides it's going to go away or the service is no longer profitable. We saw Best Buy do this with some of their smart devices. They're like, well, we didn't sell enough. We're going to turn this off. So that hardware you bought, it's not use. It won't work anymore. They refunded, that's fine. But thinking about these kind of small area networks as now they're just meshes and you put your things around and they automatically connect and start to share. Is this a future, again, driven by data collection and monetization? Or how do we maintain the agency over our data to be allowed to make conscious choice? And this is the kind of thing where we as citizens need to make sure we talk to our legislators about the things we want out of these. My needs, my desires will be different than yours, but make sure you talk to the people making the laws about this and what you want and help them make the decisions that are right for the country.
I feel like Amazon should give me 20% off on all my future orders because I'm such like an open book when it comes to searching things, that they know what I want so well that I just continue to buy more and more and more.
So your privacy has a cost.
Well,
yeah,
you're willing to sell it.
And where I thought I was going to end, we'll end one more. AT&T recently came out with a proposal for a new set of discount packages that was it cellular? Was it home modem? It was one of their connectivity options that if you allowed data collection, your price would go down. They tried this a while ago, but in the inverse, where the base price, it's assumed data collection and you could pay more to get out of it. They flipped, their PR people finally must have stepped in and said, hey, people aren't going to like that imagery, and flipped it. But it's now again a new, you know, it's a new of give us your data. We will, we'll reduce your price.
Car insurance. Let us track when you're hitting the brakes and not hitting the brakes, how hard you hit them, et cetera. And we'll reduce your rates, right? But if you're pumping those brakes really hard and you're speeding up really fast, boom. You know, so it's a brave new world.
But you get to make those choices. And I think that's actually the right path. The automatic, you choose, do I want to plug this thing into my OBD2 port? Do I want to do these kinds of things? And I think that's really important. And I like that we're heading that way. You know, people think I'm a downer about where privacy is going. I actually like that people are insisting on having these kinds of choices. And I think it's the right direction. That's my view.
No, 100%. No, I totally agree with you. And more and more companies, I think, are being more transparent about what they're going to do, what the trade-offs are. And as long as we continue down that path that, hey, here are all the cards, I'm going to lay them out on the table. This is what you're giving up, but this is what you're getting in return. I'm fine with that, because that is a good conversation that is being fully transparent on what the impact is to the given person.
Yeah. And keep talking about it. Keep it top of mind.
Absolutely. And on that note, we're going to end for today. Eric, Brian, thank you very much once again. Another great debate on what is becoming a favorite topic. Maybe we'll make a commitment that once every 10 episodes, we'll do a privacy talk. What I don't, you know, people can get sick of hearing us rant about privacy, but hopefully not. But if you are, let us know. feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net, email, Twitter, @securitydebate. Let us know what you think. Email us, contact us. Let us know what topics you want to hear in the future. We want to talk about lots of things, but we want to talk about the things you want to hear about. Thanks again for listening. And we look forward to seeing you again on the next Great Security Debate.